We're going to talk about this tonight, and the theme is about the greatest thing. I wonder if tonight, if we had a kind of quiz to start with, and I was to ask you, what do you think is the one thing you like to base your life on? What would you say? Money? Or fame? Or success? Or fun? Or security? Or being noticed? What? Because whatever it is, what is the primary thing we say we're going to base our life on, that's going to shape all the decisions we make. And over these next few weeks, I want to talk about what God says the most important thing is. It's love. If we're going to choose to base our life on one thing, God says to us, the thing to base it on is love. Even the Beatles knew this. All you need is love. They were right, sort of. Love is the most important thing, although I guess we do need a few more things as well as love, but this is such an important thing. But what is it? You know, if I came around tonight and we did a second question, can you define love for me? If and I guess there'd be a fair measure of agreement among lots of people that, you know, love is just a hugely important thing. But what is love? If someone came around and asked you for a one-sentence definition, you know, something you could fit on the front of a T-shirt, what is love? What would you say? What do you think you might say? Well, I have we have a dictionary at home because Marge teaches English to speakers of other languages, and it's a special computer-generated dictionary. What they've done is they've analyzed how words are used in ordinary spoken English and written English in the world today. And I looked this up for love. I thought this would be very helpful. And I found out, do you know, there are 20 ways that love is used in written English today. 20 ways. And however, that does include things like 30 love and tennis and a few things like that. I have a friend in the United States. He's not a friend. I know him. I've had my photo taken with him. He's given me a hug. He's very famous. I'm not, but he wrote me a note after that. I kept it for a while. And his name's Rick Warren. He's the pastor of a very big church in Southern California. And he tells a story of how he got a brand new 24-volume encyclopedia. And one day he was speaking on this topic of love, and so he got out his 24-volume encyclopedia, for which he'd paid a lot of money apparently. And he thought, I'll get the ultimate definition. So he looks up the word love. And there was no entry at all. It just said, for love, see emotion and see sex. So he looks up emotion, and there was an article there which he said he found one reference to love, which didn't explain what it was at all. And he turned up sex, and there was a 5-page article, not surprisingly, in which there were 3 references, I think, to love. And none of them explained what it was. And what is it? You see, in English is not really a very expressive language. I mean, most of the world is craving to learn English, but it's not a very expressive language when it comes to emotions. We have one word in English for love. I'd love a hot dog. I'll love you for all my life. And it's the same word, which kind of trivializes the whole thing. Now, the Bible, the New Testament, the second part of the Bible, which records the life of Jesus and his followers, was written in Greek. And in Greek, there are 4 words for love. And the first thing I want to do tonight is talk for a little while about these 4 different words for love, which are found in the New Testament. And the first one is affection. It's a Greek word for affection. And it's what we saw an example of it on that video, where there were parents and they were starving and they were giving some of their food to their children. And affection is typically found in a family. It's a warm family kind of word. It's the kind of love that a parent has for a child, and those of us who are parents live in great hope that one day there will become a moment of response and the kids will respond with deep affection to their parents. And that's affection. That's the first kind of love. The second kind of love is friendship. In the ancient world, actually, they believed that the happiest and most fully human of all the loves was friendship. We tend to think it's romantic love, which I'll get to in a moment. But in the ancient world, they didn't. They thought friendship was the greatest kind of love that you could experience, the love of one friend for another. Now, friendship is normally something that you experience with people of the same sex, men with men, women with women. Although not completely, because what real friendship grows out of is a shared interest and shared values. You find you do things with people, and there are some people you're doing these shared interests with that you really click with, and they become very close to you. They become your friends. There are difficulties if a deep friendship develops between men and women. If you're both unmarried, and you find you share very deep interests and the same kind of values and a lot of interests together, very quickly, almost certainly, that friendship will pass over into romantic love. However, if one or both of you is married and a deep friendship begins to form, then you have to be very careful, otherwise it will move over into inappropriate love. But friendship is a very deep thing. A lot of people have said to me, I have no friends. And I feel incredibly sad when, those people feel sad too, because that is a sad state of affairs. Friends are people who are there for you when you need them. That's the second kind of love. And the third one I want to spend a lot more time on, because I've noticed people are interested in this, and it's romantic love. The word in the New Testament is eros, from which we get erotic, but that's not quite the Greek meaning of the word. It's much more about romantic love. And this is where in English, when we talk about being in love or falling in love, you know, like you're out of control. It's the term, I fell into a ditch, is the same as I fell in love. It's something unexpected. You weren't counting on it when the day began. You got out of bed in the morning, you went out and you fell into a ditch. You get up in the morning, you weren't expecting it, and suddenly you meet someone and you fall in love. It's unpredictable. Unlike falling into a ditch, falling in love is a deeply satisfying emotional experience. It is hugely pleasurable. It is arguably the most pleasurable experience you can ever have. Romantic love is a wonderful thing. Wonderful thing. It's romantic love that has inspired millions of songs. People write about, interestingly enough, I think over human history, the two topics that have inspired most songs are when people fall in love with someone else or when people love God. And through history, millions of songs have been written about both these two things. This is a profound, deeply emotional thing, romantic love. So I want to talk about romantic love tonight, and I want to say five things about it. The first thing is that in our society, it's presumed that romantic love is a prerequisite for marriage. We would never dream of saying to a couple, hey, you ought to get married. If you said to them, do you love this person? They're, oh, I don't know, really. And we would say, well, you got to fall in love first. Then you fall in love. Did you know that for most of human history, and in most places in the world tonight, marriage is not based on romantic love? For most of human history, and you crowd over here, you would find this inconceivable, but for most of human history, and in most places in the world, it's your mum and dad who choose who you're going to marry. And they line up and we would think this is intolerable. We've grown far past that. You know, we've become so much more enlightened today. We understand that marriage is based on romantic love. The only thing is that traditional societies are much more stable than our kind of society we've got today. Maybe mum and dad knew something after all. But marriages like that may work or they may not work. And Martin Luther led the Reformation in Germany about 400 years ago. And Marge said to me this morning, I quoted Martin Luther, and she said, people won't know who Martin Luther is. He was a German. And 400 years ago was a hugely significant historical moment in Europe when the Reformation began. Hugely significant. He was a hugely significant person in the last millennium. And when the time came for him, because he'd been brought up as a Catholic priest, you see, we don't get married, and then he became Protestant. And he decided Protestant pastors all had wives, and so he'd better have a wife. And it was a bit like that, really, and he married this woman named Catherine von Bora. And she had just had a broken engagement with a man that she was deeply romantically in love with. And then Luther came along to her and said, "Catherine, I think we ought to get married." And he said his own admission was, "I wasn't in love with her, and neither was I burning with passion." And they got married. And we would think, from our perspective, this isn't going to work. But it turned into a hugely successful marriage. And, you know, it's been written about for hundreds of years since. Some of you may have seen a movie last year called East is East, which was about the clash of a traditional society that was actually Pakistan. And this Pakistani family moved to Bradford, where, you know, hundreds of Pakistanis live in England. And it was the clash of the expectations of the kids growing up in this family where mum and dad arranged the marriages, and how the first child in the marriage, they were prepared to go along with this, and the second one wasn't going to have anything to do with it. And that's the interesting clash when a traditional society meets a modern one. So this whole question, is romantic love a prerequisite for marriage? Well, we would say yes, absolutely. But most societies, most human history, haven't actually said that's a necessity. They've got some other things, which we'll talk about. Second thing about romantic love is that it's incredibly powerful. I think this is probably the most powerful human emotion you experience. You fall in love. You're out of control. These emotions surge through you, and they're very pleasurable feelings. You love this person, they float into your consciousness, and the trees are a deeper shade of green, and the stars shine brighter at night, and the music sounds more beautiful than you've ever heard before, and the grass is greener under your feet, and nothing troubles you because you can't wait to be in the sight of your beloved. It's a wonderful experience, as long as it lasts. But it is incredibly powerful. I've come to feel it's much more powerful than I actually originally thought, because I've noticed something. Over the years, I've been in this job for a long time, and during the 30-odd years that I've been here, I've married a lot of people. Well, I've conducted the marriages of a lot of people, and don't know what I was going to say now. Oh, yeah. I've connected the marriages of a lot of people, and one of the things you notice is you see a couple who get romantically in love, you know, and the stars shine out of the other person's eyes and the music is playing, and they're infatuated. But you know the two of them, and you know about the respective backgrounds. And I've had experiences where I've sat down and said, "Look, I think you better think real hard about this marriage, because look, I really want to say this to you as kindly as I can, but I have severe doubts that this is going to work." And I used to get amazed by this, because I found that people couldn't hear what you were saying. Like, they ignored you. Now, most people don't totally ignore. I've found that if you give suggestions and advice and so on to people, most people kind of take it on board or at least respond. But I used to find this experience, I mean, not that I did this a huge number of times, but on a few occasions I did this. I think I really said, "Oh, you've asked me to marry you, and I've got some real serious reservations, and I owe it to you to tell you. Because if the marriage doesn't work, you're going to come back to me, and you're going to say, 'Why didn't you say something to us if you had reservations?'" And I said, "I just want to say this to you." But I've found no one has ever listened. And I've just thought, you know, have I just picked on a few stubborn people or something? But I've come to realize that the experience of romantic love is so strong, that you can't hear anything contrary. Because you know why? Because love is blind. And I think the feeling I've picked up from people is, well, you don't think it's going to work. Well, okay, now we've identified too there's going to be some difficulties for us, and we think it may be difficult and hard and so on. But look, quite frankly, no one's ever said this, but this is the feeling I've got. But quite frankly, I'd sooner be miserable with this woman than happy with anyone else, because I just love her so much. So I've concluded love is not only blind, it's also deaf. And you know, on a few occasions it's been so sad because, you know, it hasn't worked. And I've never, ever, ever had the nerve to say to someone, you know, I told you so. Although I must confess I felt like it, but wouldn't be a very gracious thing to do, would it? And so it's such a powerful, powerful thing, and you need to be real careful when you get into it. Incredibly powerful. The third thing about romantic love is that marriage doesn't necessarily turn it off. I had a married guy I was talking to a while, he'd come to me, and he was talking to me a while ago, and he said that, he said this, for him it was an unexpected experience that happened to him. He said, I've got a really great marriage relationship with my wife, and we have several kids, and we get on just great. But there was this other woman that he was involved with in some organization they were involved in, and he said, I've been getting these romantic feelings for her. And he said, I'm kind of troubled by it. What do you think I ought to do? And I said, two things. First one is, start putting a lot more energy into the romantic side of your own marriage, because this is normally a bit of a flashing orange light. There's something, some trouble back home. And the second thing is that, in fact, it's not uncommon for this to happen. And that's not the big deal. The big deal is what you're going to do now. I said, you want some advice? He said, I sure do. I said, don't go with it. So you're having these romantic feelings, so don't follow them. Don't give in to them. Because if you do, think about it. I said, if you don't, what you'll find is that though these feelings may seem so strong at the moment, if you don't give in to them, it is only an emotional feeling, and it will pass. And the grass isn't greener on the other side of the fence. There was a woman going out this morning, she gave me a little piece of paper because I mentioned this morning, and she wrote it out for me, the grass isn't greener on the other side of the fence because it still has to be mowed. Well, that was very wise. Don't give in to it. Because if you do, you'll wake up one day and it will have gone. And you'll think to yourself, goodness me, what a disastrous mess I could have made of things. If you do give in to the feeling of romantic love, and I said to him, if you left your wife and you gave in to this feeling of romantic love, it would last for longer. And in the meantime, you would have destroyed your marriage. You would have ashamed yourself in front of your kids. You've got a ministry in the church, you will have lost that. And all for what? All for this other woman. And one day, you're going to wake up, and the romantic feelings for her will have gone too. And what will you be left with? Someone who you may not respect as much as the woman you're leaving now. It's just not worth it. Weigh up the cost. It's just not worth it. Don't go with the feeling, okay, you've got it. I mean, that can happen to anyone. That's not the big deal. It's what you do with the feeling once you've got it. Don't give in to it. Don't follow it. It'll pass. Fourth thing about romantic love is that today, very sadly, romance has been replaced by sex. And this really is a huge tragedy, because if you go back a couple of generations, romantic love was celebrated, experienced, enjoyed. People wrote songs about it. But today the feeling is, let's cut all this laborious way around. Let's just cut to the chase. Get to the sex thing as quick as you possibly can. And that's the ideology of thousands and thousands of people out there today. Maybe the first date or the third at the latest, and we'll get on to it. I don't know how many people now I've had come to me who followed this kind of ideology and who've said it's so meaningless. And at the end, I've had so many men or women, as the case may be, and I feel so empty. You know, there are actually some men and women out there who've lost the capacity to relate to people of the opposite sex any other way but sexually. And they're confused. by this whole thing. And so that is really a path to a meaningless existence, a real quick one. But there's a lot of other people today who are saying, well, okay, if that's not the basis for sex, then the basis for sex is romantic love. But the problem is romantic love is not a basis for sex, because romantic love is simply a feeling, and it will pass. And what happens then? The Bible makes it very clear that the basis for sex is marriage. And Raywin gave this magnificent message on this last Sunday night, which was far better than I could have done on the topic. And the Bible makes this so clear that God's value here is that sex is based on marriage. And if you ask why, it's because that's the only foundation on which it could be built. Romantic sex cannot be built on a foundation of romantic love, because the romance comes and goes, and all you're left with is a series of affairs and cheap sexual relationships. Because, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, marriage is based on a foundation of covenant love, where two people commit themselves to each other for life, and that provides a shelter under which a sexual relationship can develop. And that's the biblical pattern. And why has God said this to us? It's because it's the most fulfilling for us. God made us. He wired us up. He knows what works for us. I think this is the third week in a row we've actually kind of addressed this topic here on Sundays at 11 and 7. But you see, everyone else in society, and some people, I feel uncomfortable talking about sex in church. Hey, I want to say to you that everybody out there is talking about this topic. And people come to church and all they hear is deathly silence on the topic. It's like we've got nothing to say on it, or we're ashamed of the topic. Hey, this is God's subject. He made it. This was a good thing the way God made it and the place he intended it. He made male and female and he put them together and he said, wow, this is very good what I've made. And if it's true there are people who figure this subject shouldn't be addressed in church, and I've heard there are some of you, I mean, hey, everybody's talking about it. And we of all people have got the inside running on this. God's told us in his book what it's all about and what really works for us. The last thing is, and this may be a real strange point for some of you, is that according to the Bible, marriage isn't based on romantic love. It isn't. The reason? Romantic love is a feeling. It comes and goes. Can't be trusted. Marriage is based on a covenant love, on the unconditional commitment of two people, one to the other, who commit themselves for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, till death parts us. And that is what marriage is based on. One of my heroes in life is a German named Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And Bonhoeffer was martyred by the Gestapo during the Second World War. He was here we are, got a picture of him. He was 39 when he was killed. During the Second World War, not everybody in Germany went along with Adolf Hitler. And there were a number of Christians who stood out against Hitler, and the leaders of this confessing church, they called themselves, were mostly put to death. And Bonhoeffer was a leader in the German resistance movement, and he was arrested by the Gestapo, and a few days before the war ended he was killed in a mad frenzy of killing the Nazis went in for just before the end of the war. And for a long time he was imprisoned in a series of concentration camps. Dietrich was in love with Maria. He was engaged to her, and from his prison cell he wrote a series of love letters to her. And these have only just been discovered in the last year, and they've been being edited, and they're going to be published next year. The Love Life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. No one knew about that. They disappeared after the war, and they've only just found them. But while he was there in prison, he was asked by his niece if he could write the message for her wedding, because she was getting married, and he wrote the sermon to be read by someone else at her wedding. And in it he said this sentence, and I think this is so profound. From now on, this is in his niece's wedding service, from now on it is not your love that sustains your marriage, but your marriage that sustains your love. Now, I've run this by a few people over the years, and people say, say that again. From now on, it's not your love that sustains your marriage. Now, nearly everybody thinks that. It's love that sustains a marriage. No. It's marriage that sustains a love. Because you can't build a marriage on romantic love. It comes and it goes. Can't be trusted. But the covenant commitment that you make to each other, you can build a love on that. Because when you can trust each other, that the first time we run into a difficulty, my wife or my husband are not suddenly going to walk out on me. And in the shelter, love, real romantic love can develop. One other thing that a marriage is based on, a good marriage, and that's friendship. The first kind of, second kind of love we've looked at tonight. Not all marriages are based on friendship, but my observation is the strongest marriages are based on friendship. Actually, Marge and I sat in bed last night, and I told her what I was going to talk on, and she got a bit nervous because she said, how much of this are you going to talk about up front? But I said, tell me about the place of friendship and our marriage. And we agreed together that this was the foundational thing out of which everything else we've had has grown. If you're really good friends together, that is just so important. You've got the covenant commitment, and then you've got a deep friendship. And out of this kind of thing, real romantic love will grow and be sustained. If you just base it on romantic love, we've got this dizzy feeling, you know. Oh, it passes. And what are you left with? Dead feelings and no commitment and no deep friendship. I better get off this. I could print it. The fourth kind of love is God's love. How does God love us? Does God love us with affection? You know, is God like a parent loving a child? And the answer is yes, he does, because Jesus said that God was our Father. Does God love us like a friend? The answer is yes. Jesus said, I call you my friends. Now, what about this one? Does God love us like a lover? The answer is yes. Because in the New Testament, it talks about Jesus being the bridegroom and his followers being the bride. And Jesus took us to be to himself, like a bridegroom takes a bride. God is a lover. But there's something missing. Because in all these things, affection, friendship, and romantic love, love is a feeling. You find the person really appealing, and you like them, and so they're your friend, or you give them affection, or you fall in love with them. But when Jesus came, we saw something incredibly profound, and that is that God actually loves the unlovely. He loves the people who we may not feel attractive. We may feel repulsed by them, but in the Bible it says that God loves us. And sometimes people's behavior may grieve God deeply, but he still loves. And that's the great message of the Bible. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. Now, what kind of word do you find for that? How do you describe that? That God loving the world so much that he felt great affection for us, or he wanted to be our friend, or he wanted to fall in love with us? I mean, it's God reaching out to unlovely people like us. And so the early Christians, they found another word. It was around, but hardly anyone used this word, because it's a word that's very, very hard to translate into English, and it's the word agape. And it's hard to describe, to translate it into English, but it means a kind of selfless love, or an undeserved love, or like a loving kindness. And Jesus said this kind of selfless, self-giving love, this is what God demonstrated by sending Jesus into the world. And Jesus said, this is the kind of love that, more than anything else, this one quality is to be the mark of those people who are my followers. Now, if you were to ask, if we carried on this conversation we were having at the start, and I asked you this question, this is the third question tonight, what is to be the mark of a follower of Jesus? You might say, well, they go to church, or they pray, or read the Bible, or they give their money, or they... Well, There's one mark, one supreme mark. Jesus said this. A new commandment I give you. Love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. And that World Vision documentary tonight, that was just a brilliant illustration of what it's about, of selfless love. And there's one chapter in the Bible that we're going to look at over these next few weeks that more clearly than anywhere else spells out what love is, and it's 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And I'd like to read to you just the first few sentences of this chapter, just as we conclude tonight. If I speak in human or angelic tongues but have not love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but have not love, I'm nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and surrender my body to the flames but have not love, I gain nothing. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. You see what he's saying? Some people actually... The mark of an authentic follower of Jesus is you speak in tongues. And that's the mark if you're a really deep spiritual person, you speak in tongues. It's that you love. And other people say, if you prophesy, imagine if you have this amazing prophetic gift and you can see great things in the future. Whoa, you'd be a spiritual giant. And Paul says, no, doesn't count. I mean, they're good things to pray in another language and to have prophetic powers, but at the end of the day, that's not what marks you out as a follower of Jesus. Or if you give away all you have to the poor. Well, people can give away their money for all sorts of reasons, because they want their name on a plaque or whatever. But if you don't love, it just doesn't count. Love is the greatest. It's greater than faith and hope, and they're wonderful things. But only love lasts forever. In heaven, you won't need any faith. In heaven you won't need any hope because you will have arrived. But love goes on forever through all eternity. Now how do you love? Yeah, okay, if love is a good thing, what do you do? I mean, how do you get to love? If God loves us, do I force myself? Do I think, yeah, I should be a more loving person? So, I wake up in the morning, I think, all right, today's the day. And you kind of psych yourself up, I see some guys these days every week doing this kind of stuff. Is that how you do it? It isn't. You know how you get to love? You open your heart to God's love. And God wants to flood our being with his love so that his love can overflow out to other people. We saw a great illustration of that tonight. Because people say, why doesn't God do something about all the stuff that's going wrong in the world? And the answer is that God has done something. He sent his son and he's called people to be his followers that we might be recipients of his love that might overflow to the world. And the blockage doesn't lie with God, it lies with people like you and me. And we don't want to open our hearts to God's love, and we get scared about reaching out in love to other people, especially if we've been hurt. And we don't want to get hurt again. It's this quote from C.S. Lewis to finish with. To love at all, he says, is to be vulnerable. Love anything, and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly be broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give your heart to no one. Lock it up safe in the coffin of your own selfishness. The only place outside heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers and anxieties of love is hell. That's our choice, really. We can think, why should I reach out and love to other people? It's none of my concern, that's their problem. And one guy said that to me the other day. And if you want, we've all got this choice. If we want to lock our lives up in our own selfishness, make a coffin for ourselves, you could end up in the place which is utterly devoid of the love of God through all eternity. But why do that? When we can be an instrument of God's healing love in the world, when we can experience the love of God for ourselves, this can become a great motivator in our lives. And so God's offering us tonight, He's offering us His love. And He wants us to understand the nature of love. He's come with a kind of love that is so different to the other loves we know. We know about affection and friendship and romantic love. But when God's love was demonstrated, no one could find a word for it. It was kind of outside of our human capacities, a totally selfless, self-giving love. And that, said Jesus, is to be the mark of my followers. And that's the challenge of this message tonight, really. Two things. One is, are you willing to open your heart up to the love of God? And the other thing is, are you prepared to reach out in love to someone that you've been holding back from, that you'd sense in your heart God wants you to reach out in love to them? So let's bow our heads for a moment and we'll just reflect on this. There may be someone who comes to mind that God would want you to reach out in some loving way to them, and you've been holding back from doing that. Maybe you've been afraid you'd be hurt. And some of you may never really have opened your heart up to the love of God because you're afraid of that too. What would it involve? You know, what would God expect me to do and all this kind of thing? And so tonight I'm going to lead us in a prayer, and you can just pray this in your heart if you'd like to. Oh God, I want to say to you tonight that I've been holding you at a distance for long enough. And tonight, oh God, I want to surrender my heart to you. I want to open my heart to your love, Lord. And I want to reach out and do the difficult thing that you're calling me to do, to reach out and love to someone in some situation. Give me a heart to do this, Lord. Because I want to demonstrate that I'm a genuine follower of Jesus. And I ask it in His name. Amen.